Mother's Voices. I'm your host, Monica Hadley. And our guest today on Writer's Voices is Cici Tien. Now, Cici was born in China and immigrated to the United States when she was a year old. She grew up in central Illinois, graduated, which is not very far from where I am right now, which is southeast Iowa. She graduated from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign with a degree in history and then attended Harvard Law School. So she's a writer, a lawyer, an avid reader, and a lifelong Midwesterner, no matter where she lives. Her debut novel, This Place is Still Beautiful, was an Indies Introduce and Indie Next Pick. And the novel that we're talking about today is All the Way Around the Sun. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Cici.
No worries. Thank you so much for having me, Monica. I'm excited to be here.
Okay, so with All the Way Around the Sun, your protagonist is also someone who was born in China and immigrated to the United States, although at a later age. So it's not autobiographical in that sense, but are there elements of it that are autobiographical?
I think that, like, for me, like any one of my stories, there are some autobiographical elements to it. And I mean that very broadly in the sense that even if there are like specific plot points that are not relevant to me, I'm usually bringing something personal, whether it's like emotional or otherwise, to the story, because that's just like how I feel like I'm most motivated to write. Like I view writing as kind of like bringing some element of my experience to the page. So, you know, with my first book, the setting of the book is based on where I grew up. And I just have like such a fondness for my hometown. And I wanted to use it as the setting of one of my books. And then for this one, I think that there's a lot of different personal elements to the story. I think that like a lot of the feelings and emotions that Stella has in terms of like isolation and uncertainty are certainly things that I felt to some degree as like a teenager, like going through like the process of coming of age and like figuring out what I wanted to do with my life. And then more specifically, I did not stay in China for very long before my family immigrated to the United States. I did spend quite a few summers in China when I was a child, particularly after we all got green cards when I was 10. We went back to China almost every summer. And there's a part of the story in flashbacks where Stella goes back to this like Chinese village where she was raised with her grandmother, and that village is based off of a village where I spent my summers and where my paternal grandparents are from ancestrally.
Mm-hmm. Now, kind of one of the main themes of this book, I mean, there's a lot of themes, but there's one about the fact that Stella was raised by her grandmother up until age, what age did she?
I think in the story, it's like maybe like six, seven.
Okay. Yeah. And then she came to live with her parents at that point, and how that affected the family's ability to really bond, and how it impacted all the members of the family. And that is something that is not uncommon in Southeast Asian culture, to have grandparents raising the children while the parents are off working and making a better life for the family. And is that something that you've had personal experience with as well, or know people that have?
I certainly know people who spent like some period of time with their grandparents before coming to the United States. Like you said, like I think it's something that's particularly more common. I wouldn't say like very common, but like everyone probably knows of one person or two people in Chinese American culture who experience this to some degree. I think that like particularly for my parents' generation of immigrants that came to the United States, like it's very hard to come to a new country and establish yourself. And I also think that Chinese culture is quite collective in nature. Like your family is like very, you and your extended family are all viewed as like one whole essentially. There's much less of this concept of like your immediate nuclear family. Like your bonds and your relationships are just a lot more fluid and connected with your extended family. So it sort of feels very much like all of those people are still just part of your larger family. And so grandparents do tend to be quite involved in child rearing. And although in my immediate family, I don't have any specific satellite baby experience, my brother did spend a year in China when he was four before he went to kindergarten. He was born in America. But when he was four, he spent an entire year in China in the village that's kind of like referenced in the story with my grandparents. I think it was like for my parents, there's kind of like this feeling that they wanted him to be able to spend more time with my grandparents. Obviously, when they came to the United States, we lost this like connection with all of our extended family in a very real way, even though I was lucky that my grandparents would come to the United States and spend time with us. Like my maternal grandparents and paternal grandparents like rotated essentially would like come live with us for a year, and then the other set would come live with us for a year. And so I grew up speaking Chinese because my grandparents didn't speak Chinese, and so I was forced to speak Chinese with them. So my Chinese is actually like at a pretty good level for somebody who grew up in the United States.
Mandarin or
Mandarin, yes. But still, it's like we were quite distant, right, from extended family. And I think my parents wanted my brother to be able to spend more time with my grandparents. And they felt bad for their own parents in terms of like not having that closeness with their grandchild. And so he did go to China for a year. And then when he came back, it was like really different. And it was harder, I think, than like we were expecting. It was odd for me, for one, just like to have a sibling be gone for a year. But also, when he came back, he didn't speak any English. He completely forgot his English.
Oh, wow.
So he had to relearn English from scratch, and that was like when he was going to kindergarten. And I think that had like a very large impact on his experience and like my family's experience. And I just thought it was kind of an interesting way to also draw out one of the themes of the story, which is Stella feeling like she's emotionally disconnected from her parents.
Yes.
Some of that is like generational and cultural. I think that like certainly I'm bringing some of my own experience into the story where sometimes I feel like with really serious, heavy topics, I don't quite know how to engage with my parents on it. I don't know if that's like I just feel uncomfortable doing it. I think that like we're not used to doing it. Like we're not used to like talking about a lot of those things. And I feel like it's hard to bridge that communication gap. And Stella certainly feels that as well. But I think that like part of the story is also compounding on that barrier with the fact that like she didn't grow up with her parents in her formative years. And so that inherently leads to some amount of like distance between the two of them and trying to figure out how to reestablish that connection when it's already like difficult to establish given like the generational and cultural gap.
Right. I talking about the satellite children and the, grandparents raising the kids, even in people who stay in China, that's a common phenomenon between the villages and the cities, where the grandparents stay in the rural villages with the raising the children while the parents go off to the city for jobs and they see their kids twice a year, one of them being right now. There's some holiday going on right now that all the factories shut down for a week, and the first week of October, and then of course the Lunar New Year being the other one. And for in American culture that seems so peculiar, but it's very common, and it's just a cultural difference, I guess.
I think it's a cultural difference, and it's also like an economic necessity in many ways.
Yes, of course.
Like, yes, I do think that there is like that collectivity in mindset that I was describing earlier in terms of like viewing your extended family as not different than your immediate family. Like, it's all just all part of like one family, basically. And so staying with your grandparents is like not really that different than spending time with your parents. But also like I think that like the nature of society is now such that it's like very difficult to figure out childcare when you're like working. And childcare can be expensive and grandparents are free. And so like, I think that like to some degree, many working parents now to when they can do get support from their grandparents as well. Like my parents-in-law watched my child until full time until he was 18 months. After I went back to work, my husband was working because, it's free and because we trust them to watch our child. And I think that like when you already have kind of like a much more collective view on like family and everything, like it becomes the natural option to make sure that like who's going to watch your child and like how can you afford to continue working and still be able to have children and like that's just kind of like what a lot of people have to do these days.
So, Cece, what town in Illinois did you grow up in? I'm curious.
I'm from Bloomington Normal.
And
My
how?
brother actually went to Iowa State though. Or
Oh,
not
really? University
University
of
of Iowa.
Iowa in Iowa City. So, what made you just want to write novels?
I've always wanted to be an author. I think that just like when I was young, I always liked to write. Like even when I was 7, 8, 9 years old. I remember when I was in third grade, I think I won, or at least like I placed in like a citywide essay competition, like personal essay competition. It was like what my family means to me, and with a prompt, and like everybody wrote it, and I think I like got like fourth place or something, and I got to go to this like big banquet and like read part of the story and like did got like a ribbon, and it was the first time I think I realized that maybe I could be good at writing. And I don't know if it was like that. And then I just was a big reader. I was a big reader. And I remember when I was little, I used to just carry around a notebook and I would like write stories. At that time, I mostly wanted to write kind of like historical stories because like, I didn't know what I wanted to write about. And I think that when I first started writing out, I focused a lot on sort of like historical fiction or like fairy tale retelling, something where there's like kind of an existing structure
Structure.
to write off of. And then when I was in my teens, I wrote a lot of fan fiction, as I think like many people of that generation did, like back when the internet was like we were all starting to get on the internet. And seeing that there were places to share your writing. And fan fiction is obviously like a great place to start because you already have characters that are pre-baked and kind of like oh a universe that you're familiar with. And I just like I really enjoyed doing that. And then when I was 18 in college, I started writing original fiction again. So I always wanted to be an author. I think it was just something that it takes like a while to come to fruition, right? I wrote like probably five or six like full novels before I actually landed an agent and then
Oh,
got a book
wow.
deal, which was my first book, This Place Is Still Beautiful, which is not uncommon. I think that like many authors have written books before they actually got their first one published.
But not usually five.
Oh, I know people who've written like 10 plus. I mean, it's very common. And I think I do it because I love it, Like I wrote all of those books and I didn't have the expectation necessarily that like each of them would get published. It's just something that I enjoyed doing, and I continue to enjoy today.
Okay, so are any of them books that you could publish at this point? Could you go back and because
Like
obviously,
fix them up.
because obviously you got better as you went, and those books were your education. You didn't do an MFA because you were doing a law degree, and so that was your MFA really, and so but. Are there any that you're attached to that you feel like sh deserve a place in the world?
That's a great question. When I started writing original fiction, actually, I was writing fantasy. And I only made the switch to contemporary later on. Some of those earlier novels are fantasy novels, and I had a lot of fun writing them. But I honestly just don't really feel like I necessarily want to write fantasy anymore. And so I don't think that there are things that will probably be brought into fruition. Like, I view them as something that I did that was fun and educational and like helped me become the writer that I am today. But they're not necessarily stories that I want to like go back and revisit,
Okay,
if that makes
okay.
sense.
Yeah, of course it
Yeah.
does. Of course. Now, what were you writing fan fiction? What books were you basing it on? Was it Harry Potter or was
Oh yeah, I mean, I feel like this is really like excavating things that like I'm not embarrassed about it, but like it is yeah, like I never told anyone like in my real life that I was writing fan fiction, I think so. I started out writing Harry Potter fan fiction. I think that
Okay.
was just like the thing that most people did. Obviously, Harry Potter was so big
Yeah.
back when I was growing up. And so yeah, I cut my teeth writing Harry Potter fan fiction, and then I started writing Percy Jackson fan fiction actually. So I have like
Ah.
quite I wrote a lot of Percy Jackson fan fiction, particularly in college. Yeah.
Wow. That's so much fun.
Yeah. I love the Percy Jackson series. I think it's so great.
Oh. You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is C.C. Tien, author of All the Way Around the Sun. Now, I found this book really moving and so fascinating to read. And it's a road trip story. It's romantic. It's about grief. It's about family. It's about coming of age. You packed a lot into one book. So tell me how the plot for this book and the characters, did you start with the idea for the plot or for the characters?
That's a great question, and I think actually like I can tell you a lot about how the story came together. That kind of mirrors your question in that like it was very difficult for this book to fully come together because I think that there were a lot of things going on, and I had a really difficult time balancing all of the threads that are happening in the story because there's like Stella's relationship with her brother who's passed away at the beginning of the story, and there's flashbacks, but like he's very much still like an emotional core of the story. And then there's her relationship in the present day with her family and sort of the barrenness, I guess, like of that relationship. And then there's also like the romantic side plot that she has with her childhood friend that's also developed throughout the course of the story. And I think that like part of the challenge in drafting this book, which went through many drafts actually, was being able to balance all of those threads in a way where they felt interconnected, but still felt like each of them was getting enough airtime. I think in many of the previous drafts, the issue was like, okay, you know, it's unclear which of these threads is like the most important thread. And how do these things all fit together? Because they kind of feel disjointed in some ways because there's like so much going on. So, yeah, I think actually when you're like, oh, there's a lot going on, yeah, it was actually very difficult to like get to like make a cohesive story about it. So, in terms of like how I came up with the idea, I think that like initially, what I came up with was like that I wanted to write a story about like the themes of grief and being able to talk to your family about this complicated subject. I have always found in my own personal experience that like when something tragic happens in the family, I don't necessarily know how to connect with my family members about it. It feels so awkward. Like you're almost kind of like alone in your grief. Like you know that each of you is like suffering, but you don't quite know how to like reach out and bridge that gap. It like almost feels embarrassing in some ways or like too raw to talk about it with others. And so I wanted to be able to like write about that concept of like something potentially tragic happening in the family and how that lack of communication or that vacuum can create a lot of difficulty for everyone involved in being able to find closure and move on. And so that's what I really wanted to write the story about. And then I think like all the other pieces were built on top of that. I also have said in the cover copy as well that the story is for fans of The Farewell and Past Lives, or like two Asian American movies, if you haven't watched them, that came out in the last like 6 years or so. And I think there's been just like a slew of incredible Asian American filmmaking that's happened in recent years, like with those two movies and like Minari and Everything Everywhere All at Once. There's just been like so much great Asian American filmmaking. And with those two movies in particular, usually when you have comps or like comparative titles for books, there are things that you come up with after the fact to be like, oh, if you like this book, then, or if you like those things, then you should like this book. But actually, when I watched those movies, I knew that there were elements of those movies that I really wanted to bring into a story. So when I watched The Farewell, I think it was like one of the first movies where I felt so connected with the main character in a way that I have rarely experienced in watching media. Because it was like so specific to my cultural background and upbringing that you just don't see in like Western filmmaking very often, obviously. Like the place where the grandmother in China lives, and like the apartment, and just like the decor, like it just looked exactly like what my grandparents' apartment looked like in China, like where their apartment was located. Like when you're driving through the city, it just like reminded me so much of the time I had spent there. And then specifically the concept of lying to your grandparents about like some major terminal illness is something I think that's also more common in Eastern cultures than in Western cultures, where I think that like truth can feel very paramount here versus like in Chinese culture, where I think that there's like this real feeling of wanting to protect your loved ones and that being more important than the truth necessarily. So I definitely had grandparents who were diagnosed with cancer toward the end, and they never found out that they had cancer
Oh,
because we never
wow.
told them that they
Oh,
had cancer.
wow.
They knew they were probably sick, but like when like you know I had a grandpa who was like basically dying in the hospital. They never told him he had cancer. And then my grandmother got cancer as well, and she was in her 90s, and basically we just like treatment at that point would have been quite limiting anyway. So like she was never told that she had cancer until she passed away. And I think that like that concept can feel very shocking to people in the West. And I never really seen that portrayed in a movie before. And when I watched that movie, I was like, oh, it's such an interesting culturally specific thing. And I think it really just goes to the emotional core of the story as well, in terms of like not telling people the truth can feel like it's done for their well-being in many ways. And like that lack of communication aspect, I think it fit in really well with the story that I wanted to tell. So I think all of those things kind of like fed into how the book came together.
Wow. Cece, would you like to read a little bit from the book for us?
Yes, I would love to.
Great.
Okay, let me find a passage. I'm going to set the scene here. So for people who are listening, like the premise of the story is basically that Stella Chen, she's a Chinese American. She was born in China and raised in China for years with her grandparents before she came to the United States. They moved to Illinois originally, and then at the start of the book, her brother has passed away in college unexpectedly. And that was very difficult for her family. It's now been about a year, and her family has moved to California. I think because partly because her father got another job, but partly he got a new job because I think they wanted to get a clean slate, like being in Illinois, there was just like a lot of memories there. They wanted to like start over. So they've moved across the country to a different place, and Stella's transferred all of her classes to a new high school. And she's feeling like very isolated. She still is kind of like struggling with the aftermath of her brother dying. She's now in the process of like potentially having to apply for colleges. And I think she's feeling a lot of ambivalence about it because her brother died in college. And, most people don't go to college and die. And so she knows it's not like rational to fear going to college, but I think she still feels some kind of way about it because it's inevitable given her personal experience. So the setup for the scene is it's her first day at her new school in California, and she is going to the counselor's office to talk about her class schedule. I sat in the counselor's office during my lunch period, nervously tapping my fingers against my thigh. "Let me pull up your current schedule," the woman behind the desk said. She was youngish, maybe in her mid-20s. Her brown hair was pulled back in a neat ponytail, and she had bright red glasses. "Sorry, the internet is a bit slow today." I scanned the walls of her cramped office. I tried to create a plan for what I was going to say to advocate for myself. The Stella of a year ago would have written bullet points in advance, but the Stella of a year ago also wouldn't be in this predicament in the first place. "You're enrolled in all standard curriculum for a senior in the state of California, except that we've allowed you to transfer over the AP literature class here." "Yes," I said, "but I had my transcript from Mount Pierce and I was in three other AP classes. I was in all the AP classes that Mount Pierce offered." I handed over a piece of paper to her. She scanned the sheet. "Right, AP Bio, AP Calculus, and AP European History. I remember." She hesitated. "Miss Chen, our curriculum here is rigorous, perhaps even more rigorous than what you're used to. And your grades the first semester in those courses, they aren't what we'd expect for someone continuing on that track here. Even if you were a current student, we would have been having serious discussions around whether you should consider easing up." She slid the paper back across the desk. I could see the grades popping back out at me in bold. C minus in AP Bio, D in AP Calculus, C plus in AP European History, A minus in AP Literature, the one class I qualified to keep here. My parents hadn't seen these grades. I had quietly ferreted away the copy before we moved and vaguely blamed it on address problems when they didn't receive anything in the mail. "I'm sorry. I cannot con justify slotting you into those courses here. I would be setting you up for failure when it will already be difficult to jump into a class halfway through. Second semester is going to go so quickly. There is no time for catch up." She tilted her head, not without sympathy. Seeing the letter grades in front of me felt freshly humiliating. I had never been assigned anything like them in my life, not even when I first moved to the United States and didn't speak a lick of English. I wasn't always straight A's like Sam, but I had certainly never sniffed a D before. "I had extenuating circumstances," I said. Her eyes widened. "I see. What might they be?" "I see you were a good student for much of your high school career, but then last year was the first year you started taking AP classes. It can be a big adjustment." I couldn't look at her. I stared at the transcript sitting between us. "There wasn't any kind of contextual explanation for your GPA ever on your transcript. It was just a bunch of letters, just your high school achievement boiled down to a single decimal number. It wasn't as though there could be an asterisk appended to my senior year indicating that my brother had died. If I wanted people to know that, I would have to tell them. I realized that this was the beginning of it all. I would have to tell this woman, whose name I couldn't even remember, whom I just met minutes ago. I'd have to write it down in the common application so I could tell colleges, probably in response to one of those inane essay prompts, like, recount a time when you had faced a challenge, setback, or failure. How did it affect you, and what did you learn from the experience? Whenever I explained my transcript, I'd have to do it within the structure of that crude framing, something that happened to me and what I learned from it. It felt infantilizing and cruel to assume that there was anything that could be learned from Sam's death. And it also seemed unbearably crass to use it as a shield for my academic performance. The woman was waiting for me to respond. I couldn't. "It was nothing," I said finally, my throat so dry I could choke. She closed her laptop. "It's fine. It'll be less stressful this way. You'll see." That's it.
And that was CCTN reading from All the Way Around the Sun. So, how long did you work on this book?
So this is the second book in my two-book contract that I initially got in my first book deal. So I got my first book deal in 2020, and then This Place Is So Beautiful published in 2022. And you can see just like generally publishing works at a very glacial pace. But I started writing this book in maybe, I think I started it in like late 2020. And then I probably turned in a final copy of it in early 2025. So it took like about 4 years to write. Yeah.
Now you have a day job too.
I do. Yes, I'm a lawyer.
So what is your writing schedule like?
It's changed a lot. I think the biggest thing that's impacted my writing schedule is actually having a kid. Before I had a kid, it was actually not that big of a deal to have a day job and write, because you still have nights, you still have weekends. And the way that I would like to write, if I have my druthers, is like having like a big chunk of time, you know, like 3 to 4 hours. Like I love to go sit in a cafe, just kind of like get in the right headspace and really marinate in the story as I'm drafting. And that just like isn't a reality for me anymore in most cases, because now I have a toddler, and I had a baby in 2022. So that was like a few months before my first book came out. And so the bulk of this book was drafted after I had a kid. And now I would say that like most of the time I'm writing is like in the 30, 45 minutes before I go to bed. That's primarily when I do all my writing, which doesn't seem like that much time.
No, I mean, how can you even get started?
I think that like I had to make a much of a mental adjustment in terms of like really flipping the switch, because I don't have the luxury of making a long transition period. Like I just have to be ready to go when there is time. And that took a lot of time, and like it was a big adjustment. And I think a lot of that adjustment was made over the course of writing this book. And so it's still something I'm getting used to. But again, people don't think that that's a lot of time. But like, if you write 200 words a day, eventually you have a book, right? Like eventually you get there. It does all accumulate. Even if you're not writing 1,000 words a day, if you're consistently doing some amount of writing on a weekly basis, you will eventually write a book. So
Have you ever thought about what it would be like to just be writing? You know, to
Yes, I think about that every day, Monica. I think the reality is for most authors that being a full-time writer is very financially difficult.
Yes.
Publishing is an industry where your next book is never guaranteed. You can never say that you will get another book deal unless you are like a Sally Rooney or somebody who's like, you know, a regular New York Times bestseller where you just know they're going to acquire your next book no matter what. I haven't reached that level yet. Never say never. I think one of the things that I learned in publishing, which I think is something that I take with me day to day, is that publishing is a very hard industry. And I think that like a lot of people think that you're living your dream when you're a published author, which I am living my dream. Like we all published authors, I think, are living their dreams in the sense that we get to write and people get to read our writing. And that's just an incredible thing. But it's very difficult in many ways, I think, that you may not expect. It's difficult emotionally because it's very personal and you have very little control over the business aspects of publishing. And it's very difficult financially for the vast majority of authors. And one thing that keeps most people going, it definitely keeps me going, is like, there's no way to fail in publishing unless you stop writing. If you just keep writing, like your next book, anything can happen with your next book, right? Like that's the one thing you always have to remember, is that if you write another book, anything can happen with that book. And whatever happens with that book, if you write another book, anything can happen with that book. Every book is like a new, brand new chance in your career. And so I think that there is no way to fail unless you stop. So that's kind of like the attitude and perspective that most people, I think, bring to publishing in order to be able to like survive. But yeah, I mean, I would love to be able to do it full time one day, but I think that like you just gotta take into account the finances.
Yeah. And also, you know, writing is very solitary. And as a lawyer, I'm sure you have quite a bit of interaction with other people. Would it be challenging for you to go from that to sitting alone in your room all day, every day?
That is true. I think that it's definitely a, it would be a big lifestyle change, because definitely as a lawyer, the vast majority of my day is spent in meetings. So there's like a lot of social interaction with that. And that is something that I probably would miss. One of the things though, that I am trying to like do now that I'm like mid-career, middle of my life, there's like so many more obligations and responsibilities once you're like older and you have a family and whatever, is that like I want my job to just like be my job. Like I don't want to like put so much of my like emotional well-being and or like need for social connection as part of my job's responsibility. Like I want to be better about like cultivating relationships in my real life and like building that community and network in a way that's like not associated with my paycheck and associated with like a precarious economic environment.
Good
so
point.
So that's like
good
a kind
point.
Of the way, but I do think that like, yes, I do really like the social elements of being a lawyer, and that is certainly something I would miss.
So as you write, do you write like a whole entire first draft kind of start to finish, or do you do it where you write some and then go back and work on that and then go on to the next part? And do you have an outline or just a general idea of where you're going with the story? I know that's a lot of questions in one.
Yeah, so I definitely write from beginning to end. So I'm a chronological drafter. I don't skip around. I usually start at the beginning of the story and then I just write all the way through. And that's also partly because I'm not a big outliner. I don't really have like a very detailed conception of the story before I start writing. So by necessity, I kind of have to discover it chronologically. I know that there's like a quote out there about writing, and it equates writing to basically like driving at night with headlights. You may not be able to see the whole road, but you'll be able to see like what's immediately in front of you. And that's enough to get you all the way there. And that's essentially how I write. Like, I really am kind of discovering the story as I'm drafting it. And all of those details really come into relief as I'm discovering them on the page. Before I start writing, I do usually have like a framework conception of the story. Like I know how I want it to start and I know how I want it to end. And I usually know how I want the climax to be and maybe like some pivotal scenes in the middle. But like I don't have like a lot of detail about how it all knits together. And I also just don't like outlining. I have done outlining for like later drafts where like once I have a draft, then it's easier to kind of like be like, okay, well, these scenes aren't working. So like what's going to go there instead? And then like pull together a roadmap. But like in the initial drafting phase, I very rarely have an outline because like I genuinely just like don't know what the story is going to be about.
How many drafts do you do?
So it really depends on the book. For this book, I wrote, I think, like four major drafts of this book. So that was a lot for me because for all the way, or so for This Place Is Still Beautiful, my first book, I really only had like two primary drafts. Like that story was just much more fully realized in the first draft, I think, than this book was. And this book took several drafts to be able to really like land a lot of the storylines and everything. And so it was very frustrating to get all the way through this book because that was so many drafts for me personally. But I know people who write way, way more drafts than that. I think it's just like very dependent on every person's individual process. And it's very dependent on every individual book.
Yeah. Do you ever, like when you were writing this book, did you ever like say, okay, this isn't working, I need to change this, and you change it, and then you're like, oh, nope, it was better the way it was, and go back to how it was before.
Definitely. I mean, I think that like this book, many things in this book changed to and fro between different drafts. But what I will say is that I don't like to revise while I'm drafting. So I would like to get a full complete draft before I think about whether different elements of it work or not. Because so that was also kind of like frustrating with drafting this book, because I knew, especially in some of the earlier drafts, as I was drafting through the book, that I was like, look, this is not working. Like, something about this is obviously not working, but I just can't go back and fix it right now because I need, like, I need to see the full thing before I can, like, figure out how I can fix it. Like, I can know that there's something wrong with it, but, like, I don't even know in what direction I can fix it. I just need to write the whole thing. And that's, like, I think difficult in the drafting process because, as you're drafting, you're like, okay, I'm drafting garbage. Like, I know that this is not good and that it's probably going to get cut and that it's not working out. And that doesn't feel good when you're writing, but sometimes that's just part of the process.
So were there any things that surprised you? You know, things that ended up coming up in the drafting process or the revising process that you'd say were a surprise that this happened in your book?
I think that there were many surprises in the drafting process. I think that, like, one of the things that I always talk about as kind of, like, truly something that I didn't really expect is, people ask me why this book was set in California. And I picked California as a setting because I wanted to pick somewhere that I had spent some time. So, like, my first book is set in essentially like my hometown, and so it was very easy to write about because I had like firsthand personal experience about it. And I just find like settings to be like really important to me, and I want to pick a place that has some kind of like personal meaning to me. And so originally I picked California because I work in tech and I'd spent a lot of time in the Bay Area, and I really liked the Bay Area, and so I wanted the story to be set in the Bay Area. And originally, it's a road trip story, right? Like, she road trips down the California coast to visit a bunch of different California schools. And originally, they started out in the Bay Area, and they road trip down to San Diego, and then they went back up. But if you read the book, you'll find that now the book starts in San Diego, and they drive up toward the Bay Area, and then they go back to San Diego. And that's just, like, changed for essentially plot reasons, as the plot changed as I was drafting. And at one point I made it so that I wanted the climactic scene to happen in the Bay Area instead. And if the climax was going to happen in the Bay Area, then they couldn't have started out the road trip in the Bay Area. So then I changed it so that it started out in San Diego. And then over further course of the drafting, the place where I originally wanted the climactic scene to take place, it never even ended up manifesting. So, like, the whole reason I originally wanted to set the book in California is no longer even present in the story. So,
do they make it up to the Bay Area?
They do loosely make it up to the Bay Area, yeah, without providing any spoilers about what happens.
Yeah, yeah. And are you, the colleges that they're going, this is, you know, a college visitation road trip,
yeah,
and are these all campuses you're familiar with and have visited?
No, not at all.
Oh.
So actually I did a podcast earlier in the week where I think I received the best compliment that I've ever received on this book, which is that there's a good portion of the book that takes place at UCSB, UC Santa Barbara. And the interviewer on the podcast went to UCSB, and she was like, I was so excited that UCSB is in the story. Like, I feel like you did an incredible job portraying UCSB. Like, it just felt so nostalgic to me, and like, your descriptions were so on point and the vibes were so right. And she's like, have you ever been to UCSB? And I was like, I've never been to UCSB. And I feel so honored that somebody who actually spent significant amounts of time there think that my description of that place is like accurate. I now do really want to go to UCSB because as I was drafting it, I spent a lot of time looking up Google Images, and like I think I went on their website and they had like a virtual tour, and I like did a virtual tour of the campus. I like what other research did I do? There's like a they spend some time at a house in Montecito, in UCSB, like near UCSB, and I went on Zillow and I like picked out a house in Montecito that I wanted the story to be set in, and I just described that house. So, yes, many of the places in the story, like I actually have not gone to, and so that was quite different than the first book.
One of my favorite parts of the story is when they get in trouble on their road trip, they get caught basically sneaking out. I don't think that's that much of a spoiler. And but how the auntie and uncle, who, and that's very common, like pretty much all in Chinese culture, is that common that all people of your parents' generation are referred to as auntie and uncle?
Yeah, I mean, generally in Chinese culture, you refer to people by some kind of relationship title rather than like their names. So if they're of your parents' generation, they're like auntie or uncle. If they're your grandparents' generation, then they're grandma or grandpa. Even like people who are your age, if they're older than you, you would call them like older brother, older sister. If they're younger than you, you would call them younger brother, younger sister. So there's like much less reliance on names than like on like relationship titles.
So even if they're not actually your older brother or older sister.
Right.
Yeah. And I know that like Mei Mei is younger sister, and that most younger sisters in Chinese families have that as almost a nickname, right?
Yeah, because that's just like what they're called in the family.
Yeah. And that was really touching too, because she wasn't anymore a younger sister.
Yeah.
So anyway, one of my favorite parts was how the uncle handled their being getting in trouble.
I will say that growing up in my community, we didn't have any extended family, but we did have a community of like my parents' friends who were all Chinese American as well. Like a lot of them were same, like first generation immigrants. When I was younger, like I always remember we would like have parties and stuff on the weekend, and like all the kids would just like run around and like play games and stuff, and like it would be a big potluck and everyone would cook, and then afterwards, you know, the parents would drink and like play cards or whatever, and we would like stay at the parties until like midnight or one. And so like even though we didn't have like extended family, there were a lot of, I guess, adults that were like part of our like upbringing and community that we would call aunties and uncles. And the uncle character is definitely based off a specific uncle character from my hometown. So if anyone from my hometown does end up listening to this, like maybe you can try to guess which uncle I based that character off of. But yes, it was based off of a real person.
That's so cute. Now, when Stella goes back to visit her, there's one scene or one time when they're going back to visit the grandmother in China, and the grandmother's having to leave the village or the town because basically the whole town's being destroyed. Is this something based on things that really happened?
Yes. Yeah, so the village that I spent a lot of summers in my childhood is in fact called Dajizhun, which is the village that's named in the book. And it does not exist today because it was requisitioned by the Chinese government. And so the last time that I saw it was when I went back to China with my husband after we got married. We went for part of our honeymoon. We went to China so that he could like meet all of my extended family. And we went back to the village where I'd spent time. And there's definitely one flashback scene that's like very much kind of like based on my personal experience there, of just like going through the village and just remembering like all of those memories and realizing like that place was just like not gonna, it was just not gonna exist anymore in like 3 months. They were basically just gonna mow down the whole thing and turn it into like a development or whatever, and everyone had to move out. We had to dig up all of our, we have a ancestral gravesite there. Like we had to take out all of our ancestral remains and like find a new location for them. And so it's weird. That's like a place that's basically disappeared. It like only lives in this, in the memories of people who were once there. And so it kind of fits in well with the story because it's like similar to Sam, the brother, right? Like who disappears. It's like disappearing people, disappearing places, things that you remember about those people and places and like what you do to carry them forward.
I wonder, the China, in China, they overdeveloped. There's all these empty houses, so these people lost their homes for something that may not have ever even really been needed. That's kind of sad.
I've never gone back since then. Obviously COVID hit in 2020, and so last time I went back was in 2018, and I haven't gone back since then. And I don't know if I would go back to that area because it would just be like very odd
Yeah, it
to
sure
see
would.
like what it has now become, right? Like there's almost something comforting about the fact that I saw it before it disappeared, and like now I can just like remember it as it was, and I don't have to see like what it's become.
Yeah. Now, Stella, when she lived in Illinois, was one of, it sounds like, very few Asians in the town. Where it sounds like your actual town had a whole Chinese American community. Do you think it's harder for immigrants who come where there really isn't a community there from their original culture?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very hard, and I think it's difficult, particularly when you're a kid and you're growing up. I mean, I think it's difficult for the adults too, right? Like now that I am an adult and I'm kind of like viewing it from that perspective, like I think about my parents going to, I mean, I just generally coming to America to a place where it's like not your first language and having to go to school, to work, to like engage in your second language like every day is very mentally taxing. And then to just like miss all of the comforts of like things that are familiar to you is extremely difficult. I think that one of the things that's in this story that's kind of interesting is the concept of like Midwestern Asians versus California Asians. I grew up in the Midwest, but I know many Asians now that I'm friends with who are California Asians, and that they grew up in towns in California where there was like a pretty substantial Asian population. Obviously, there's a lot more Asians in California than there are in Illinois. And I think it really shapes your sense of self and your identity growing up when you're around people and culture that are like so much more familiar to your home upbringing. I think that like, I think that like growing up in the Midwest, people, somebody at my book launch last night asked like, oh, California or Illinois, like if you could go back and do it again, like would you want to grow up somewhere where there's like a much more of an established Asian community? And like, in some ways, like, I mean, I'm the food, first of all, in California is like amazing. Like if you want, if you like Asian food, being around Asian food and like just being around being able to eat the food that you're the types of food that your parents cooked for you growing up is like is invaluable. Like it's just so it's so nice. But I really liked growing up in Illinois in many ways, but I do think that like there's some level of almost like displacement and insecurity that you feel about your identity when you're growing up in a place where there's just not as many people who look like you or relate to you or whatever. And I think that like you have like a different disposition or outlook than people who grew up in like, an enclave where like there were a lot of Asians. And I think you feel a lot more maybe like in touch with your cultural heritage in in those instances where you have access to it around from the people around you than when you grew up like somewhere where you weren't around people like that.
It's
But it,
hard for me to imagine the courage that it takes to move to a to the town I live in Fairfield, Iowa. You know, my daughter's
huh?
best friend in high school was an Asian Taiwanese immigrant family, and of course they came here to start a Chinese restaurant, which is what it seemed like most of the Asians in Iowa came here because there was a demand for restaurants and they could start a business. But you know, they were all practically the only ones in the whole town. I just can't imagine the courage that that takes to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that like I have vast amounts of respect for my parents and their friends who came to the United States to build a life that would be easier for obviously our generation. And I think that in many ways we feel endlessly indebted to them for that decision. And I think Stella feels that too in the story
Yes,
where
and
she's
that's
like,
part of the pressure on
how,
her, right?
yeah, like how,
Yeah.
like my parents did so much and how could I make this worthwhile for them. Even if your parents like never say that to you, I think that like, just by watching the immense amount of sacrifices that they've made, you feel that you have to make it worthwhile to them in some way. Because it's just it's incredible, right? Like to for them to been able to do that.
I know. It really is. And I, like I said, it's hard for me to even imagine how difficult that was. And I'm very grateful for all the people who've done that, who've come to this country and brought their talents and their abilities and their hard work and helped create what we have here. So, Cece, we're almost out of time. And do you have any sort of final words of advice for somebody who wants to write?
Yeah, I feel like there's probably like all the writing advice in the world has been given to people usually. So I'm sure that what I say here is not going to be novel or unique, but what I found with people who want to write and especially who are starting out to write is that they really struggle with feeling like what they're writing is not good or like it's embarrassing to sit there and write something that they may not feel is to the quality that they would want it to be. And to that, I say that you just have to power through it. Everyone is always writing things that they think is not good. And the most important thing is just that you do it because that's like if you go back and you make it better, but you have to write it first to be able to go back and do that. And I always tell people, like, don't get trapped in the revision cycle. Like, try to write a whole draft of something, even if it's like really bad. You just want to get the whole draft out before you even think about going back to try to revise it. Because I think the process of just having written everything is hugely important to your development as a writer and also to your belief that you can complete something.
Well, that is, I think, very good advice. And we always close with a quote. And I had found one about that I thought was really kind of fitting for this. And this is by, don't know if I'm pronouncing it correctly, Ryu Murakami from In the Miso Soup. All Americans have something lonely about them. I don't know what the reason might be, except maybe that they're all descended from immigrants.
I love that. That's such a beautiful quote.
Well, thank you. And thank you for being with us, Cece, and see you all next week on Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much, Monica.